cliffcentral.com.
Dr. Zweli Mkhize is the Treasurer General of the ANC and is a formidable force of politics in South Africa. He was formerly the Premier of KwaZulu-Natal and has a long and illustrious history in the organization. I read that there was an interesting story about your great-grandfather, one of the heroes of the famous Mkhize clan, who, of course, are from central KwaZulu-Natal. And you've obviously inherited that mantle and decided to become a leader at an early age. It's something that obviously comes from the family. Dr. Mkhize, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, Gareth. It is indeed a pleasure to be with you. I don't know how much time you've got to talk about ancestral history.
I could spend all day. It's something I love. I love talking about.
No, well, look, there's not much other than the fact that the whole Mkhize clan comes from the whole Embo people. So it's a very broad group that would have had Swazi people and a lot of people that went further down south towards the Eastern Cape, as it were. And amongst our great-grandfathers would be the ancestral lineage that broke out into Amambondo, Amambondo Mise, Amaxesibe, and so on. And then there's a whole lot of other clans that came out from there. And my great-grandfather was amongst those warriors that were during the times of King Shaka. And so everything was fine because they went and fought on the side of King Shaka until King Shaka was killed. And then, of course, the chief who was the leader of the clan, Zihlandle, was then murdered. And then the whole clan had to move further south towards where it is now, around Pietermaritzburg, Richmond, Midilovo, Mbumbulu, and it goes further towards High Flats and some in Mzimkulu. And so there's a bit of a story there, but that's really the history.
You see, I'm interested in this stuff because when I went to school in Pietermaritzburg in primary school, they spent quite a lot of time, which was odd, I suppose, for a time when, you know, education was black and white and we had a separate way of teaching the history of South Africa. We were exposed to quite a lot about Zulu history then. I remember learning about the Mthethwas. I remember learning about Sezangakhona and Shaka, and afterwards, obviously, Dingaan Mpande, Etshwayo, all of those people.
In fact, it was an interesting history because, you see, the Mkhize people lived around the area of Nkandla, towards...
Not a controversial area.
Not at all, no. It's actually a place of heroes. So
there's a famous forest there, right?
There is, yes. Yeah. That's where King Cetshwayo is buried. But Gcwabe, who was the leader of the clan, then lived around Nkandla, and then his son Zihlandlo and his other brothers, Sambela and others, lived in that area. And my great-grandfather was in that area. He was called... Nomtai and his brother Kaba. So they were very well-known warriors. There's an interesting story of how King Shaka tried to go to attack one clan, which is the Majia clan. Majia is Nzimande, it's the Gwala, and so on. So Zihlandlo then said, look, here's the route that you can follow, and only to find that King Shaka couldn't get up the hill because there was a mold, algae on the rocks. So he kept slipping until he came back. But when he came back, he found that Slanjo had brought all the cattle which he had intended to go and fetch from Majia. And of course, Majia never forgave Slanjo because he said it was betrayal. But on the other side, Shaka then got a bit worried that they outwitted him and got the cattle before. So they asked him, how did you go? He said, well, we thought that you were looking for those cattle for yourself, so we thought we must fetch them for you. And King Shaka's mother, Nandi, then said, listen, that man, don't make a big fight with him. He's very wise, so you'd rather make him an ally. So he made him an ally. And so out of that, then because King Shaka was killed by his brothers, Then they went for all the allies, and right. So they killed this one, and then they moved over. But my great-grandfather, actually, in that fight, he rescued one young man who belonged to the Gwala clan, and he said, no, don't kill him. He'll be one of my, you know, Utibi, who will carry my snuff and my shield when I'm going to battle. And then when they all had to move, he had to move with this whole, with this young man who ultimately grew up. So a whole group of Gwala people around Pietermaritzburg were actually brought up in the Mkhize clan as part of the. So I think the last ones who survive now, who are in their probably in their 80s, 70s, 80s, could probably be the first lot who have had Gwala is their surname. The others were using Mkhize as the surname. So it's a very interesting local history.
I find this stuff is, people who care about this stuff are the people who also care about tomorrow.
Sure.
Very often. I think that we have too much of a gap in South Africa between people who know only about the very recent history or the history that concerns them and not enough about what came before. Because if you have that long lens with which to see the world and the development and the evolution of our culture, I think you have an appreciation for what an interesting and diverse place South Africa is and how much of a contribution each of the elements have made.
Actually, it's very interesting because in my mind, I always say even the whole problem of ethnicity, if people understood that there was never anything pure about ethnic lineage, they would not be as, you know, fussy about the tribe and the ethnicity and so on. What for me was very interesting is to discover that Sibiside was the head of the whole Mkhize clan, was actually the great-grandfather to Njani and Mavovo. Mavovo is my great-grandfather, but then Njani is the one whose sons was Mpondo, who grew up to create the Mpondo clan, kingdom now, and then Mpondo Mse, who was a twin, and in the same way, and then there was Xesibe. All of them are in the Eastern Cape.
Right.
And if you move further from Mpondo land, you will get towards Mzimkulu, and the people who were there were actually descendants of Mashukumbela, the Mkhize clans that when they fought, they ran away and followed those. And then further, if you go to High Flats, are the descendants of Bakwali. Bakwali is a warrior who actually stabbed Shaka and threw him onto a ditch and jumped over him, and then he praised himself, and Shaka was trying to look for him when he was now friends with Zihlanjo. And in the process, Zihlanjo didn't want to spoil the friendship. So he told his brother, listen, you better move.
So
move
he ran south. Away to there.
So he moved to the south. And so there's order in how people got packed into the way from Eastern Cape up towards, Pietermaritzburg, towards the north and so on, because of the fighting that used to happen there. They're not the only ones. Even if you talk about the Zuma clan, for example, there used to be neighbors with the Mkhize clan, and in the process, King Shaka thought they were too powerful, Msholozi and Zihlanjo, so I wanted to see who must be a better one to keep. So he got them to fight, and then of course the fighting got the one to be moved away, and so on. So
who lost in that fight? This is important symbolically to people, because Msholozi
it wasn't a fight of their own. So I think it was important that they were forced to fight because Shaka wanted to improve loyalties for himself. But I think the important thing here is that we are one people. If you go through, it's not only just us. If you went back to the people in the Eastern Cape who are called Amahlube, a whole lot of them would have come from the western part of KwaZulu-Natal under Langalibalele Khatebe, in whose memory the first president of the ANC was named. Langalibalele Dube was named after that, Amahlube. But if you go further towards Tandi, there was another whole clan that lived there, the Ntuli Pele clan, that actually some of them had cannibalistic tendencies. So during those days they were scattered. So a whole lot of them are in the Eastern Cape, the Heshele area and so on, but a whole lot of them are in Zambia, in Northwest, in
that's some distribution.
Oh yes. So there's a whole mixture of how people have come together. So I think it's just important
to say. There's no authentic being Zulu, as opposed to one tribe being more Zulu than another. They're all, you know, of course, is there that much of a difference between those people who now call themselves because they speak the language Xhosa and so on?
Look, it's more a language and culture kind of spiritual or attachment, ancestral attachment. It's more that kind of thing. And I think it's important for youth or young people to be taught some of that history, because then they will know that human beings are human beings, and African people are African people. They would have come from different parts. There's a lot of, you know, people coming together. You go into an area and you adopt a particular
custom,
you know, custom, yeah, as it were. There are others which are very interesting. I've got friends who are vendors, and interesting with them is that amongst them is a group of people who are called Lemba.
Now Lemba, I know Lembas. Lemba, they're Jewish.
These are Jewish
people,
from,
yeah,
Sana, and Sana,
right,
is in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
In Yemen, and the whole of the around area of Ethiopia and so on. So, you know, even then, when you talk about them as being Jews, there are a lot more black Jews, possibly more than those who could have been white Jews. It's actually very interesting. And so apartheid created a very difficult lens, you know, color lens, that made people to create very, you know, categorically, this is my tribe, this is my group, this is my race.
And they exploited that for their own purposes by turning people on each other and pointing out those differences. You know, sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend stuff a lot of the time. And clearly, you know, the history of the Zulu people in the struggle has also been complicated because of, you know, people like Mangosuthu Buthelezi and what went on before 94 there. So obviously, it's not one-dimensional.
No, it's not one-dimensional at all. It's actually, you know, obviously, I think the history and the description of people is interfered with by the politics of the time. And so I think that it is good to understand that for purposes of you know, current existence, people will take a particular identity, but that identity is not like, it's an exclusive identity that does not involve any other, you know, groups. There is somewhere where we're all interrelated, and so it's an important issue to, you know, I think the call which was made by the leaders of the ANC to cast the demon of tribalism was a very, very appropriate call. And I think at this stage, when we talk about non-racialism, it's exactly the same issue, because it's about just recognizing the humanness of every individual, that we're all human. There are obviously lots of differences that you could look at, but essentially we're all human, and so there could be cultural, linguistic differences, religious differences, physical features differences, historical, ancestral lineage, and all of that. But all of that doesn't quite count. What counts is that we're all human, and we can really, you know, focus on the best of our humanity and build the best society that we can ever build, and we can live together.
And I think in this country, more than ever, we need to have that sort of resolution, that between us we decide to move forward together rather than apart. Because I do feel a lot of the time, and it's difficult to have this conversation with some politicians, I don't think you're one of those, that politicians will exploit those differences for their own purposes. Because a fearful, threatened, or even the perception of being threatened by people who feel that they are either stronger or weaker than others is often the means to drive them into voting along the lines of tribalism or of race or of ethnicity or of language. And obviously that stuff can be very destructive.
I think focusing on divisive features of society is a problem. It's important for all leaders to focus on what unites us, what makes us, you know, a stronger society. And I think the definition that was created in 1994, when we said South Africa belongs to all who live in it, was more about saying, you know, we are one nation, and as it was said, united in our diversity. And the diversity was our strength. It's not our weaknesses. Mm. So the fact that we can identify differences in our culture, languages, ethnic, racial, characteristics, basically makes us a very diverse community, but that's really our strength. Whereas in other countries, that is a basis on which people fight and kill each other. There are many countries where people, because of ethnic differences, you hear of ethnic cleansing. When there are issues of religions, you hear of religious intolerance. This kind of religious group gets attacked by the other. The stuff that you don't see in South Africa, and I think it's a huge advantage that sometimes when we let our guards down, we might actually begin to erode on something that really was a powerful glue that pulled all our people together.
Philosophically, do you think that we've moved away from that idea, that genesis of this nation in 1994 and before that, when they were debating what the constitution would look like, and when CODESA had been established, and where many of the leaders of the ANC took the moral high ground and decided this was the kind of country they wanted to create? Do you think we've altered course? Do you think we're still on course? Do you think that we have we've had some diversions?
I would say the majority of South African people would like to live in peace. They would like to see racial harmony. They would like to see coexistence of all South Africans. However, there will be those who will take advantage and then maybe still backward in the thinking, and therefore they've got more of emphasis on the racial issues. That is there. I think the what complicates it, though, is that some of the tensions we still have to resolve relate to issues of inequality, issues of poverty, issues of poor access to resources, to social and economic networks that will offer opportunities, and sometimes to take advantage of those, some people might want to use those racial classification as a basis on which they can have an advantage, and therefore they would like to exploit the situation. So I think we have diversions, but I think if we are not careful, we can erode the fiber that really had been created to bind the society together. I think therefore we need to always be very alert of the fact that we should be very intolerant of racial incidences where people would want to emphasize the conflict on the basis of that. But in so doing as well, that's why I think it becomes important for government to rapidly move with a kind of program of transformation that will make sure that the processes of addressing the past disadvantages in education, in employment, and
of this, of course, could take generations. It won't be accomplished overnight. We hope to do it as quickly as possible.
Yes, certainly it will take generations, but I don't think that you want to say to society, wait, you must remain poor for the next five generations. But
not
I think
sure.
What you are saying is that you want to create a movement that makes everyone see where the country is going.
Can I link in a not particularly pretty way some of the discussion we've already had around your own family background and your own understanding of, ethnicity and culture and all the rest of it, and what the ANC is at the moment? And forgive me if this is not a particularly elegant metaphor, but many people regard the ANC at the moment as being something of an aristocracy. And I don't want you to be defensive, because it's just something that I've thought of based on the conversation I've had with some people recently about how there's a certain group of families and people who are considered ANC royalty, with no pejorative meaning necessarily there. They're families that were involved in the struggle, people who are still with us, who were very much at the forefront of that struggle, and that between them there's a very select network of people who control not only the business of politics, but the business of business in some ways, and that many people view this as an elite, and that this elite can be described as some kind of aristocracy post-1994.
it would be an inaccurate description. An aristocracy you would define as people who, by virtue of being born in a particular family lineage, they inherit a position in society.
But many people in the ANC inherit positions or are deployed to positions because of their connections.
No,
I mean, this is how some people see it. I'm just perhaps an oligarchy is a better way of saying it. It's also an ugly word with ugly.
No, but let's clear this one first, that there is no one who is in the ANC position simply because they were born of someone who was in the struggle. They would have themselves been participating in their own rights as individuals, and it's very likely that they would, because they would have been brought up in an environment where, you know, the understanding of the politics and the ANC was the, you know, family gospel, and therefore they would participate. I mean, I'll give you an example of the Sisulus. The entire family was donated to the struggle, literally. Each one of them would have had their own roles as such. And if you went to a lot of our children, you will find that their understanding of politics and their attitude towards the ANC is different because of their close proximity to that issue. The issue of people being deployed into positions, I again think that needs to be, it's a good policy that has either been abused or misinterpreted. The point being that it's not so much about you being a member of the ANC, but it's more about you understanding the kind of policies. There was a time when it was very important to understand from the policies of an apartheid government and the policies of a transformative regime, a new democratic dispensation. So you would have needed people who have had that kind of understanding. But fundamental to that would have been their capacity, their technical, you know, capacity and competence in the various areas where they're supposed to be doing the work. But you will see that this ANC gets criticized for that. But the DA is doing exactly the same thing.
But Dr. Mkhize, if we look at things like the parastatals, there isn't one success story among them. I mean, we're looking at constant controversies emerging from all of them because they're run by precisely the kind of people that you're not describing. Incompetent people who are put into these positions who have no necessary skills to... We heard just this weekend of shenanigans at Eskom with tenders that are... They are so patently wrong from the outset that there's just no way to defend them, and the people in question expect us to believe that they had no idea these things were happening. The SABC, SAA, I mean, these are all probably companies that could be extremely profitable, that could contribute to the Treasury. Instead, they suck money out of the Treasury because they're run so badly. Surely that in itself is a poor example of deployment then.
No, let's deal with the issues properly. Firstly, it's not like these institutions have always been performing as badly. We are all concerned about the fact that some of them are not doing well.
I can't think of one that is.
There are many that are not doing well, and I don't think we want to run away from that. I think it's important, but there are those that are doing pretty well. But the point I think which is important here is the fact that we have to emphasize on the fact that there has to be competent management, more efficient, management, so that these state-owned enterprises can generate more profit for themselves, and that they must be more effective. But if you take the example, for example, of this controversy in Eskom, we must accept that if somebody does something wrong, they must be investigated and they must carry the brunt of the wrongdoing. But it does not actually mean, for example, the one guy that we're talking about, Mr. Koko, he has been an engineer in Eskom for many years. So technically, he's a guy who knows exactly what's going on there. Doesn't mean he doesn't make mistakes. Doesn't mean he might not have done something wrong. But if you look at him, he is not, someone that was just, brought in there who has
But you yourself know, as a person of many characteristics and qualities, you're a doctor, qualified doctor, you've been a farmer, you're a politician, you're many things, but not everybody's like that. Someone who's an engineer, for example, might make a terrible manager, and I don't know that there's that much attention being paid to, and it's not just the people, let's be fair, because sometimes the wrong person is appointed, no matter how careful the system is about who that person might be, but sometimes there's institutional rot, there's institutional decay and problem, a sort of a culture in these institutions that isn't really about excellence. I mean, Eskom would charge us more to use less electricity. It's counterintuitive. It's just, it's not a great system for a business to run at. You know this. I mean, you've also been a businessman.
Well, no. I don't want to talk too much about Eskom. I don't know much about it.
I don't want to either.
Yeah, but I mean, the point I was making to you is that you have someone who have a lot of knowledge of how the entity technically operates because he has been there for a long time. So we can't say when we find something wrong now, behave as though he didn't have that history. But we're also saying if there's something wrong, let's have a proper investigation and deal with it like that. What I think we cannot do is to keep characterizing everything because he was now put in that position as acting and that he was deployed and so on, so on, so on. That as a matter of fact, the man is acting because he was in there already. Mm. So it's not a thing that you could look at as he was brought from some outside because of his ANC connections, as it were. He was there.
But you understand these perceptions. Yeah. I mean, this is how people... And I agree that... And I know you might say... I don't want to, you know, guess what you're going to say here, but I imagine that the media plays a role in this because controversy sells.
No, the media is raising one issue. And I think let's keep to that. There is a transaction that seems to have involved a relative. Mm. And whether the acting CEO doesn't, whether he was Gareth Cliff or he was William Kize or whoever, once that thing happens, it needs to be investigated full stop.
But these things that happen, and they happen every now and then. I mean, I've met people who aren't in business with government, who aren't doing work for government, who have an idea that if they could just do that, then they would be in the money. There's this idea that the best and the quickest and the fastest way for someone to make money in South Africa is to get a tender from government. That's the widespread opinion of ordinary people, for right or for wrong. And that also contributes to this idea that there's this network of people who control everything. You know what I mean?
No, you see, the issue of people who will, you know, survive in a parasitic way on the state resources will always be there. That is a problem that you will have. At any one time, people will think that there's a shortcut towards doing something. What we need to do is to evolve a system that makes sure that we are able to fairly distribute opportunities to all people and not only reserve them for, you know, previously advantaged groups, largely white companies. You must be able to open up the space. Now, sometimes some people will think that they've got an opportunity simply because they are black, but they are not able to offer what technically is required to run that thing. So the process must be able to eliminate between the two so that you are able to open up space. And rather than in the past where, you know, black people would have been excluded, the system must now be able to consider everyone in. What it must not do is simply to take people in just because they are black, but it must take them in and not exclude them because they are black, but it must also make sure that they provide the services that is required. There's a lot of professional, technically competent black people who are qualified to do the work, and just because they would have been appointed into a contract by government doesn't make them corrupt.
No,
but at
sure.
the same time, we must make sure that we don't allow corruption
fact,
to grow.
I agree, and I think everybody agrees, but this is almost like there's one thing being said and another being done, because we see so many examples of that. And I know personally, I've got friends, successful black entrepreneurs, who are keeping their heads above water. They're not making huge money. They're kind of breaking even every month, and maybe a little bit.
Did you see them on headlines?
No, because they're getting on with their work and they're trying to run their businesses.
No, that's not the case.
But they tell me, no, these are good people who are trying to run businesses, self-starters very often.
Yeah, and I'm saying you are right. I'm saying the normal things don't make news. It's the awkward stories that make news.
What I'm getting to is that they say to me they struggle to get government work.
Okay.
And not because that's what they need or want, but they realize that there is an opportunity, particularly for them if they are self-starters, to do, but they're not in that network. You understand? So they don't know who to talk to get the tender. Then it sounds like it's conspiratorial.
No, let me say, you see, firstly, there are lots of people who are getting government contracts, and they do good work, and they are black, they are disadvantaged, and they are doing well. They are making whatever little money, whatever they are making, and work is going on, and their work is respectable. Then there are officials who are competent, who do their work properly, who will, you know, award properly, and something that's beyond reproach, and you can challenge them in court and so on, and that will go on. Then there will be others who will take chances, who will want brown envelopes, they will, and then who will go out and, you know, get people to do some work. Those are the ones we must deal with. And I would say the perception around corruption is really more because there are people who have experienced ill treatment, unfairness in the way that the processes have been run. And I, my point is that we need to deal with those. And we can't run away from the fact that such individuals exist. And therefore, what we must not do is to castigate the system as all of it being corrupt, but we must always be aware that when it's corruption, it doesn't matter. You need to be taken to the books, and you need to be, you know, properly dealt with, because the system needs to be respected for the way it is able to, you know, screen out the incompetent, the screen out those who don't qualify, screen out those who cannot do the work. Because once you get someone who will bribe their way into getting a contract, then how do you supervise them? Because they will say to you, don't worry about the shoddy workmanship because you've got your share.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. Now, that's what we need to deal with. That's the rot we must clean out. But it does not mean because there's a rot, we must castigate everyone. We must be able to separate the good ones and then act on the bad ones. And that, for me, is what I think we need to see a lot more examples on.
Now, as Treasurer General, because this is related in some way, certainly from an ANC point of view, that's a very important office in the ANC, always has been. You succeeded Mathews Posa as Treasurer General. You're in the top six, so you're privy to all the information about how the ANC runs. You're also in charge of kind of fundraising, I would assume, and also disbursement of that money, along with the committees and so on. This must be a very taxing job in and of itself, quite apart from the other roles that you have to play.
Yeah, well, it's a challenging job because, you know, you have to go out there and raise money for the organization. And like the experience you will have everywhere, whether you are government treasury or ANC treasurer, you will know that there's always less money than the wishes and the demands from all those colleagues that are working with you. And generally, you'll tend to occupy a very unpopular office, because the first answer, somebody greets you, the first answer is no.
No money.
No money. And then, of course, how are you? Okay, now we can start talking. That's the same thing with the treasury everywhere.
I had a conversation with not so long ago about when he'd just taken over, with Musi Maimane, about this idea of political parties being open and transparent about who their funders and their donors are. And he said to me, look, a lot of the donors don't want people to know who they are across the board to all parties. Some donors donate to all the parties. So they're not necessarily, they don't want to be seen as partisan every time. But in the ANC, are you careful about who you take money from? Because there are obviously some actors, international ones, local ones, business people, powerful families perhaps, who will assume that by giving money to the ANC, they're going to have some say in its activities and its decisions. Are you very careful to deal with people who don't have that expectation, or to let them know that if they give the money, then after they've given the money, it's for the party to decide what to do with it?
Yeah, that is correct. Actually, we do not disclose the names of people, but if somebody wants to go and say, well, I've donated to the ANC, that's fine. Mm-hmm. However, we are very careful about what donations we receive. Certainly, we will not receive conditional donations. If you say you want to donate to the ANC because you want 1, 2, 3, 4, we will then tell you no, we will not take that. And there have been instances where we've politely declined huge offers when we think that it doesn't look straight. We'll simply walk away from that, because the donor can disappear or can be involved in whatever, but the ANC will have a difficulty shedding the specks that would have actually been splattered on it because of the reputation of the people who went in there for particular motives. So in the ANC, when you make a donation, you will always know that it's not conditional, it's not a transactional relationship. And we also make sure that we know who's donated. Literally, we will not receive an anonymous donation. We will know. It doesn't mean we'll announce them, but it means we know where the money would have come from. And there are a number of instances where we feel no, we shouldn't even get involved there.
How often do you and the top six sit in the same room and have meetings?
Literally every week, every Monday.
At Luthuli House? Well,
largely Luthuli House, but depends where else we meet. But you don't get a notice for a meeting of officials. You just simply know there is a meeting every Monday.
I would love to just know what the atmosphere in those meetings must be like, whether it's very, you're all collegial, you've all worked together, many of you have known each other for years. So I imagine there must be some laughter, there must be, do you want a cup of tea, coffee, do you want some water? How serious do they get?
They can be very serious, they can be tense, but they can also be very humorous and funny and very, most of the time it's a very joyful approach where we meet and chat and exchange, normal greetings and experiences of the week and funny stories, humorous stories, funny experiences, stupid things that sometimes happen, the mistakes we do, and we laugh and so on. And then we sit down to serious business, things that are worrying us, things that have been raised to us by members, issues that where we disagree, and issues where we have to find solutions. One thing I can tell you is that we are always frank to each other, and we always are able to say whatever one wants to say. If it's necessary to be said, it shall be said.
People like to characterize the ANC at the moment as being very divided, and I would imagine that if the meetings are as you describe them, you don't allow rumor and gossip or everybody's individual political ambitions to get in the way of the business that you need to do. But it must sometimes be difficult to not address these things, and I'm sure that if you say everybody's frank, for the deputy president and the president to actually engage on these issues where they have to make decisions, for example, isn't very difficult.
Look, most of the stuff that we deal with is not personal. It's all about the work we have to do. And even if it were to relate to an individual leader, it's not personal. It's just that, look, for the kind of work that we have to do, there are these issues that we must face up to. If it means that's criticism, we have to be able to deliver that. If it means it's a comment on things that are being done, we have to deliver that. But also, you deal with issues on a kind of priority basis. Excuse me. So if you're not you're not going to start running into gossips and discuss things which you have got no sense of evidence as to what you're talking about, and create a scene when you really don't know what you're talking about. So when you raise the issue around ambitions and so on, look, everyone would have a degree of ambitions, as it were.
Sure.
And so they don't have to be discussed in a meeting like that. If there's an ambition because someone wants to be nominated or is willing to be nominated or has been nominated, then there's a process how that matter gets dealt with. So whatever your ambitions are, they don't matter. What matters is the process that you have to go through. And therefore, you don't have to discuss it, because it doesn't have to be discussed in that forum. It needs to be processed in a way that those kinds of ambitions have to be processed. So normally, if you say everyone can be nominated, so when it's nominations, this is how it must go. So there's no need for us to come and talk about it.
And many of those things would probably be NEC or working committee business, more than they will top six business.
Generally, we don't have to sit there and discuss individual ambitions at the level of top six. We talk about processes for elections for particular structures, and therefore there's a process of how you have to deal with those. And then you have to say, this can be done, that doesn't. It only arises if there's an aberration of the rules and someone is going across the rules and so on. But everybody knows what the rules are, so there's no need to be worrying about that.
Before we get to how the branches work and everything else, because that's an important part of what feeds into the top six, do you sometimes find yourself in the middle of an argument, a discussion, a debate, a conflict even between members on the top six? I mean, do you find, because there are very many people who aren't openly partisan to any particular point of view within the ANC, and there are people who are very forthright about where they fit into the structures, what they believe, what their ideology in terms of a preference might be, or who else they've got on their side. Do you know what I mean? I imagine sometimes you almost mediating sometimes between parties. I suppose it's a role that many people would share in the top six.
Not quite like that. You see, when you talk about top six, I talk about six people who know each other, who are respected, who respect each other, and who also have a responsibility to advise each other. And therefore, when you have to raise an issue, it would happen that maybe there's an issue on which I might be feeling a little passionate about, or maybe even emotional on. The other members have to listen, and then they'll have to indicate, well, but your emotions are misdirected, or we understand why you feel like that, but this is the issue, and then explain for you, or they can guide you.
I mean, would you ever tell the Secretary General that you are unhappy with him about something?
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. If the Treasurer General does something, and then the Secretary General or another member feels that there was something wrong done by the Treasurer General, that's the time to discuss and tell him. They say, no. What you did is not correct. I'm not happy with that. And I think then you can explain of, oh, is that so? Then you can understand each other. But it's not like you want to fear each other that you can't correct each
right.
other. No. It's actually, there is no issue we can't discuss.
The branches are autonomous, and they decide among themselves what they would like in each branch. They resolve things. They pass them up the chain. Is that still how it works? Is it still from the branch up, or has there become more of a top-down approach to the way the ANC works?
Look, there has to be a balance in leadership. On the one side, you're going to get issues from the branches, which you must then process and act as instructed by branches. Then there are instances where you must also guide the branches. And to make the distinction between the two is what really defines leadership. What is not supposed to be done is that leaders must not abuse the branches to use them for own personal interest, as it were. Now, most of the branches operate properly. There are a number of instances where we see increasingly, an erosion of that behavior. So you will find, for example, that, someone who wants to wield the power in the branch might then want to manipulate the processes. And, that's where you get the accusations of gatekeeping. Somebody would then look at it and then decide to make a list of people that are going to attend the meeting and then pretend as though there's something wrong with the others. And so if we find that, we have to act on those individuals, because effectively that's membership, that's manipulation of the structure, that's abuse of power. And so part of what we have said is increasingly being identified as a problem is those issues. And in the process, we have to take them through disciplinary process. And it can happen whether it's a branch or it's a regional leader and so on. So, for example, when you have to go through election of leadership, you need to leave the branch members to decide on their own. Now, we've found instances of people where it's alleged that they would have gone into the meeting and said, well, here's the leadership you're supposed to elect, and they read a list. Now, when that kind of thing happens, you need to act on those because it's completely irregular, and therefore we need to stop that. And we've found that tends to be associated with people who are trying to manipulate the structures, because they are looking up to an elected position or an appointment, maybe as a councillor, maybe as a mayor, maybe as a member of parliament or whatever. But at the end, what they're trying to do is to create a set of loyal leaders around whom they would then be able to control the position that they are in. Now, when you get to those kinds of situations, we have to actually deal with them. Part of what has been raised in the National General Council, what was raised by the veterans, what has been raised by the branches, those are some of the issues that are really causing us
even
a lot of discomfort.
Recently in the Eastern Cape.
Yes, you're talking about the
Lungisa.
Oh, no, that one was not even supposed to be an issue, and I think the media really made quite a meal of it, because I think the way Lungisa behaved was also problematic. In the first instance, if there is a constitutional provision, nobody breaks that. Secondly, if there is a potential for such a thing to happen, it's the Secretary General's job to send a message to say that kind of individual must know that you're breaking the constitutional provisions. Now, when the individual has received that, they're supposed to do is to respond to it positively, as indicated. Now, to argue with the Secretary General is unheard of, but also to have your own interpretation is unheard of, because the only person whose office has to interpret the Constitution is the Secretary General's office. It's not just an individual thing. It would have been based on the history of how the provision came about, what it was intended for, and what is the legal meaning of it, and what it is supposed to solve. And in this case, this issue of people serving in two structures comes a long way back. There were times when in the past, I remember Madiba came to one conference to tell Comrade Eric Walla not to stand, and there was a whole lot of things, and then a lot of controversy around it. But at the end of it, we went back to conference to tighten it up. Then there was a time when we got President Zuma to stand as chair, national chair of the ANC and provincial chair of the ANC, which was not allowed, but was a special provision because of the circumstances, and a lot of other people got involved in that. And later on, now when I was first elected in the NEC in 1997, I was actually deputy chairperson of the ANC in the province, so I served on both. And then there was a time when there was a difficulty in the interpretation. So I ended up serving as chair of the ANC in the province and a member of the NEC. And in the process, we had to correct this one. So right now, it's clear. You know, there's no two ways about it. So it shouldn't have happened.
Can we just talk about KwaZulu-Natal for a second? Because this is a province that's very close to your heart. You were premier there as well. Senzo Mkunu was premier there too for some time. And there's been some controversy about kind of how the leadership works in KZN at the moment. There's obviously flux. There's always change. Do you think that there's a problem, or are you satisfied it'll sort itself out? Do you think that the National Executive Committee need to pay extra attention to KZN? Maybe they haven't been as involved in that province as perhaps in Gauteng, the Western Cape, Mpumalanga, Northwest.
I think the National Executive Committee must pay attention to KwaZulu-Natal, because it is divided in an unusual manner, considering what the recent past has been. It has been a fairly united, solid province with leadership cooperating and working together. We didn't have this approach of Puma Singa, you get out, we come in kind of approach. And so we do need to resolve that at a political level, because the leaders who are there are leaders who have served together, worked together. And so I think it does need attention. That's the one aspect. The second aspect is the fact that there is a court case that is running, and we did try to encourage them to discuss it politically, resolve it, because whatever the court ruling would be, it's still not helpful for the organization. And of course, there are things that have to be dealt with on the ground. I've been there a few times with a lot of other members of the National Executive Committee following the tensions around the municipal elections, candidate selections, branch leadership, elections. And there are a number of things that need to be resolved at that level. And I think if you don't resolve them, that does create a challenge in the organization. But it's not only KwaZulu-Natal that's got that. I think we have to deal with this issue right across in the different provinces. We need to make sure that the authority of the branch is restored, and that there is no manipulation by leadership or senior structures. It's also important to make sure that when we move towards the national conference, there is no question about the membership of the organization, who is a member, who is not a member, and that there shouldn't be no gatekeeping.
And the legitimacy of each branch.
The legitimacy of each branch, yeah. And the legitimacy of the branch general meeting, and the legitimacy of the decision they took, the nominations that they make. All of that is going to be needed to make sure that the conference goes on peacefully without any disruptions, because in the past we had in the previous conference, two provinces had to be removed from the conference to constitute it as a conference, so that there is no legal challenge. And that gave us a lot of lessons. And we actually found that when we got to court, court didn't ask about branch mandate. They said if a member can prove that they have got an interest, they can actually successfully challenge gathering of the African National Congress, and so the ANC must give attention to those kinds of issues.
That's a lot of power for individual members then, which is a good thing.
It is in a way a good thing, but the ANC belongs to its members, and there's a song that we sing. And you'll hear it at the conference, to say we're coming to inform you, to inform all our leaders that the power is with the branches. Amandla asemasebeni. And I think that that's been the strength that has, sustained the African National Congress for a long time, and it needs to be kept so that the ANC can maintain its respect amongst the people, and that all the irregularities need to be dealt with, particularly because I still believe that with all the problems that the African National Congress has, it still remains the most relevant party to be able to take South Africa into the future because of its policies and its history, but it does need to have a lot of things corrected, and we are prepared and we are really up to dealing with those controversies and those problems and solving them so that the ANC can gain its respect, its respectability amongst all our people as a champion for the transformation of the economy, social transformation, and the improvement of the lives of all our people.
Dr. Mkhize, how much time do you and the ANC spend concerning yourselves with what's going on in the opposition, whether it's the EFF, the DA, or any of the other Smolanyanas?
we would follow what is happening, but really, to be honest, from the history of the ANC, we believe that whatever will bring the ANC down is not the opposition, but it's not taking care of challenges that are, emanating from within the ANC. So most of the time is spent dealing with the ANC. In fact, if you look at the past electoral campaigns, the ANC has focused very much on talking about the ANC, because our members have said to us, listen, we want to know about the ANC. We don't want you to tell us about the opposition. We're not interested. And so you will see, for example, that over the performance of the ANC, is largely attributed more to the members of the ANC who didn't vote rather than those who went to vote for the opposition.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, so that the ANC has to take into account.
But when it comes to things like the youth vote, I mean, the EFF are an attractive proposition to a number of young people, and maybe the young leaders in the ANC haven't got as much of a public profile as perhaps the leaders of the EFF. Does that sort of thing worry you? Do you think it'll translate into a lot of votes for them, if not now, maybe over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, the ANC has got lots of youth support. And I think the fact that the other parties are coming up and are showing lots of youth amongst them must not actually create an impression that the ANC has got youth support.
For starters, the leaders of the two major opposition parties are both in their 30s. The leaders of the ANC are in their 70s. I mean, to young people, that's almost unrelatable in some ways.
No, the ANC has got a very, deep layers of leadership. So you'll have leadership of all ages, actually. But we do recognize the need for a lot of attention to be given to youth, because leadership in the ANC is not quite more about youth, it's more about what people can offer. So we do accept that you'll have younger leaders who will be very effective even if they are young. Excuse me. So it's more the leadership skill that will count more than the age of the individual. And so we will be focusing on how to increase the visibility of that.
I do agree with you, and I certainly am not disputing that the people who are in their 70s aren't competent. But if you look at, Barack Obama becoming a president in his 40s, David Cameron, a young man when he became Prime Minister of Britain, increasingly we see young people entering into the political realm and succeeding quite well, despite a lack of perhaps the experience and the age that comes with experience.
But we are not excluding anyone. If we can identify a leader and we think that he will be suitable, we will deal with it irrespective of whether that individual is, young or old. But I mean, Barack Obama in his 40s, 50s, he's been replaced by a 70-year-old. So you can't be sure what you're going to get. So, actually, in the case of America, Barack Obama has been amongst the ones which were a bit of exceptions in the latter years.
No,
but the truth of the matter is that we will not disqualify anyone on the basis of age. If there's good quality, then the ANC will recognize that.
Sadly, on the day that we have this conversation, we've lost a stalwart of the struggle. Ahmed Kathrada, someone who people called Uncle Kathy, someone who was a real pillar of moral rectitude for South Africa, and in so many ways was a man who, and I mentioned this earlier, he wasn't just heralded for his principles, for the sacrifices he made during his life and for the struggle. But he was also one of those men who attracted very little criticism. And it's a hard thing to do in the modern world, to attract as little criticism as he did. He was universally loved and respected. Do you have any reflections on him on the day of his passing?
Well, I think we start by conveying our deepest condolences to his family and all the friends and comrades for the loss of a very inspirational leader. I can only describe his leadership as being inspirational. He was a remarkable man with that dedication into the struggle over many years, and he remained so humble. And yet when you sit with him, he was a a well of wisdom. And so the image that he's got is that of a moral compass, who would always be standing on principle and will be forthright and has no fear of expressing his views, irrespective as to who that is directed to. And he would do so because he believed, it was time for him to show leadership. And whenever there was that opportunity, he would never shy away from, showing leadership. Mm. Now, his courage over the years, and sometime when you look at his face and look at what he has done, what he has been through, sometimes you can't even recognize, you can't reconcile the two, because he is such a calm and peaceful, compassionate, loving, down-to-earth individual, and you can't actually match him with the resistance that he has had to lead and push. And so he has remained very, fondly regarded by all as a warm father figure and a very wise leader that all of us would really love to be seen in his company. And so we really have lost a real stalwart, highly respected, not just for his history, but for what he continued to do, caring for all our people and also being out there to debate issues and make sure that people will know when they are right, and when he thinks they are wrong, they must also know. And we have valued that in him, because you'll always know that with Comrade Kathy, he will not, bend his views or his principles to accommodate. He would be forthright but very gentle, and very courteous in the way he raises the issues, but very firm. And so I think he belongs to the, you know, leadership cadre that increasingly we are losing. And I think this was a leadership which was steeled in the hot fires of, you know, the struggle, and, you know, have proven themselves in that struggle, in their courage, in their commitment, in their determination, in their patriotism, in their love for the people, but also their ability to stand up for all our people and give them hope and inspiration. And so we really always fondly miss him and his contribution, and may his soul rest in peace.
Thank you. I think a lot of people will be very moved by those words, as they were by his life and his deeds. In terms of the vision that you have for what South Africa could be, I sometimes feel like we're dealing with the day-to-day stuff, and not only in politics, but in the economy. In, you know, we go from we go from problem to problem, rather than having an idea of what we'd like to see South Africa as. And everybody's focused on those small and immediate things, rather than what the great vision should be. What do you want South Africa to be? What could it be in 5 years' time, in your vision of what the country could achieve under the ANC?
I think South Africa is still destined for a great future. A non-racial society, a society where, you know, the society is compassionate, that is caring, where everyone is living, you know, a life that, you know, makes them to be able to feel that the democracy has improved their lives as compared to where we were many years ago. So I think that what needs to be focused on the one side, the whole issue of building on equality, building on acceptance, mutual acceptance of all South Africans and South Africans, reconciliation, there's still lots of space for it. But it's also important for people to know that democracy on its own needs to be supported by a lot of sacrifices. On the one side, people who have had, you know, the traumatic past have been prepared to reconcile. People who have had an advantaged past must also make a contribution in the transformation. If we do not balance the economy so that it can grow, if we do not balance the economy so that it's inclusive, it can bring a lot more people who have been disadvantaged. If we are not able to ensure that we can create more jobs and ensure that small business, you know, are developed so that people can trade, people can work, people can generate income wherever they are. One of the things that we sometimes look at and we say we're having a crisis, there's poor service delivery and so on. Some of it, there is one side where the government has delivered a lot. So you talk about up to 3 to 4 million houses, education, so many children in school and so on.
The EFF don't want you to say any of this, by the way. They want it to look like you've done nothing in 2020.
No. They know it. And a number of them have been beneficiaries to that whole process anyway. But the point which I want to make is that there's a degree of achievement that we have been able to score, but then the aspirations will not recede. They will keep increasing. Mm. And what you need for someone who's got a house, electricity, water, and a road nearby, what they need is a better life. So what is the economy that will be able to support that? That economy must make them to be able to get a bigger house if they wish to. They must be able to take their children to the best schools if they wish to. Mm. They must be able to get them to get themselves transport, a car, this and so on. So to achieve further than what the government has done is the economy that should be able to help us to, you know, lead the lives that we aspire for. That's what I think we need to be focusing on. And in focusing on that, you need a very strong balance between what government does and what business does. And that relationship between them is also very, very important to keep the confidence amongst them and to keep the kind of environment, because it is not, government has to make certain regulations that's going to ensure that there's a bit more fairness in the way people do. For example, your competition commission has to help us to, change the structure so that we don't have more of the, monopolistic kind of approach.
These cartels.
There's cartels. You need to open up more space. You need to open up, for more access to finance. For example, financial services do need transformation. You've got 4 or 5 strong big banks. You need many, many more banks in the country. You need a black bank, black commercial banks that will focus on supporting the emerging small black business, which are actually neglected by the big banks. You need people with skills must be able to open up and run various sectors. I've spoken to a number of groups. For example, you deal with the black fund managers, very competent fellows who are not getting as much opportunity to manage resources, something that would spread. So you don't have to have very concentrated ownership. So the structure of the economy does need to be opened up, because otherwise we'll not be able to solve the problem of inequality. And inequality will give us a problem of a sense of a grievance. If people feel that there's no change over the years, the income distribution is still highest amongst the whites and there are very few blacks at that level, that has got a knock-on effect on the performance of the children of those families. And so you need to balance it up. You've got a whole issue around social grants. You got about 17 million people are supposed to be recipients. Now the economy needs to reduce that so that people no longer need to be supported by the state, but they must be able to run their own lives. So all of these for us are important, but education is core. You have to make sure that the quality of education is so improved.
Are we doing well enough in education?
I think there are aspects where we've done well and there's aspects which are outstanding. And the aspects which we have done very well is the fact that, you've got a very high level of participation. So the number of children that are at school is very high. At tertiary institutions, there's resources that have actually increased the numbers to a great extent, and that, the conditions at school where children can be fed and so on are very helpful for them. But you still need to improve on the infrastructure. The skills level is actually for me one of the biggest challenge, and I think that something needs to be done to reorganize between the technical training colleges and the industries, that there must be a direct liaison, that people must not be trained for something that nobody wants to employ individuals for. There has to be an alignment between the need of industry and what gets produced, and they should be involved directly in the training, because you can only train if you're going to have the industries participating, because they will they know exactly what kind of skills and the competences that they need from individuals, so that you can get rid of people who get trained and are not either able to be employed or can't even create any form of employment themselves. So those for me would be the most important things that we must focus on. And I think that sometimes our politics is a little challenging, the fact that there's quite a lot of the Haley Bailey of contestation and so on. In reality, there's a lot more that needs to be attended to. The issue of transforming the economy, growing the economy, those issues need a focused and united approach by all of our people, irrespective of different political parties.
For the first time in the last 3 years or so, since the tripartite alliance was established, the SACP and the trade unions have been very vocal about their concerns about certain matters, mostly political and in terms of contestation of position inside the ANC. Are you concerned that you might be losing the unions?
Look, I think those issues need to be handled probably differently, because the issues around the unions and the alliance partners relating to the management of leadership transition have been raised quite strongly because of the passion that they inflame amongst the members. And I think we need to do a lot more work to re-establish the strong bonds that we have had amongst the workers, working class in general. People in the working class have been largely mobilized, during the struggle days. Even if they were not within COSATU, they still remained very loyal and supportive of the African National Congress. So I think a lot of work needs to be done there. And we have to also take into account some of the comments that come from the, alliance partners, as it were. As much as it is a problem if you got one organization wanting to discuss about the leadership of another organization. Mm. But if you take it that they are trying to alert us to what their concerns are, I think to that extent, it does need to be discussed with. We would always be concerned about the erosion of support of the African National Congress across all the strata in society, because the ANC is a multi-class organization that is supposed to be able to create a consensus of what will take
Broad
us forward.
Church.
Yes, a broad church, yes.
Dr. Mkhize, they wouldn't let me go unless I asked you a couple of things that I think we have to tiptoe around in some ways, because the ANC is not very open about how its nomination process works. I mean, it's open in some respects, but certainly it's not considered gentlemanly for anyone to throw their hat into the ring when it comes to leadership positions. Obviously, we're not in that phase of the ANC at the moment. But there's a big meeting this year. Who knows what may be decided? You're in the top six. You're one of those people who are spoken about in leadership. You're influential. You're powerful. There are many people who support you in the ANC. Is there, like we've heard with Balega Mbete saying she's available, if the ANC chooses to use her, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, there are many others who have said that they, Cyril Ramaphosa has said that he's available for whatever position they need him for. Are you also available?
Let me say that a number of the people who have been pronouncing have been told by the party not to do so. And I think everyone needs to stick to that rule.
Including you.
All of us have to stick to that rule.
But you're the only one so far who is there.
Well, let me say that there will come a time when all these nominations will be up there, and then we'll all have to be expected to comment. But I think that it's important to encourage everyone, despite the fact that it's tempting to want to throw your name up, that it is not helpful to the organization to be bringing up the names in the way that the organization has not allowed, because then it distracts the focus of all the individuals. However, it has been said that we must discuss what challenges are faced by the organization. We must discuss what characteristics of leadership that we need. And then, of course, in time, we're going to be matching the names with those characteristics. And that process is open for the branches. And I'm sure there's lots of discussion that will be going on now. Some of it will be going on as people are doing private consultations and so on. When that happens, it's fine. But what we are avoiding is to get a whole new debate out there when the organization is not ready for that. There's been lots of talks about having to change the approach. Maybe there's merit to that, but before that has been agreed to, I think we must stick to the rules. In the next few months, there's going to be nominations open, and I'm sure if you want to make a nomination, we'll certainly tell you at the time that you can do that.
You don't have to ask twice.
Well, No.
Certainly, I think that the idea that many people have is that your contribution is not at an end, and that it would be welcomed, I assume, certainly speaking to people who are and who aren't members of the ANC and who have an interest in how the ANC runs and works. It seems to me that there are a lot of people who have a lot of respect for you. You don't need to respond to that.
No, well, look, I appreciate the kind observations, but it is also not unnatural for people to be talking about the names of the leaders of the ANC. They are, after all, some of the faces of leadership in the country. So I think it is fair that people formulate their views. At some point, anyway, it's not like even in the members of the ANC, people haven't got their views. They do have their views. It's just that the point at which those views must be made public is what the organization is trying to manage.
Do you ever give medical advice? Has anybody ever come to you and say, I've got this wrong with me, can you have a look at this?
Actually, they still do. But to be honest, I still miss my patients, even if it's many, many years ago. I think that clinical practice is really a very special calling. But on the other hand, we also, as young medical graduates, decided that we're going to participate in the shaping the politics of the country, because, you know, if you don't clean up the politics of the country, you'll end up with too many patients. And one way of solving the problems of broad communities is actually being part of taking decisions at the level of policy. And I can tell you one of those, the number of them, but one of those that for me has been very dramatic has been on the treatment of HIV and AIDS, that has really changed the life expectancy, you know, from about 49 years to about 62 years, which is dramatic. And so I think that there's a role to play. In other words, if you like, we're still treating our patient. It's just that our patient is a big country.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you.
We appreciate your consultation today.
Thank you. Well,
thank you, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. CliffCentral.com.